Hey everyone, and welcome to the Pisgah Podcast.
It's us, your hosts. I'm Drew, that's Mangler, and you are listening to Pisgah. We're coming to you live from beneath a bandage. Let's jump into these news and updates.
Yeah, what an amazing springtime teasing we've been having.
Yeah, it's bittersweet for me. I definitely love the warm temps and I'm ready for it to be a full-on spring and summer. Because these ups and downs and fake springs coming up, they just kind of screw with my sinuses.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you've seen that meme that comes around whenever these springtime temps will pop up where it has like the winter, full spring, second winter, the spring of deception, third winter, mud season, and then actual spring. But usually our actual spring just lasts like a week and then it gets hot.
Yeah.
So I feel like we're in the full spring right now. We had a threat of some winter weather this past weekend. And unless you were up above like say 2,800 feet elevation, you probably didn't see anything. Saw a little bit of a snow flurry here at the house Sunday morning. But if I look up on Pinnacle Mountain behind me, I saw some snow coverage. And looking out the parkway, I could see some snow coverage. So we did have a little bit in the area.
Yeah, I could see some snow caps out in the Mount Pisgah area and definitely east, northeast. So I don't know. I think that the groundhog was wrong this year. And honestly, I think we're idiots for listening to groundhogs.
It is not very scientific.
Nope.
What we got this weekend?
Yeah, we have the Canoga Enduro kicks off this weekend. Check out EnduroSoutheast.com. USA Cycling has finally announced their location for Cross Country Nationals. It's going to be held on the East Coast at Bear Creek Mountain Resort in Pennsylvania. And we will wait with bated breath for the announcement of Gravity Nationals to round out the calendar.
Yeah, and the National Downhill Series hasn't been finalized, but what we do know is that the Tennessee National will be hosted again at Winrock Bike Park, and that'll be pretty much like a full-on week, March 17th to 26th, and then the National Series event will be at Mountain Creek Bike Park in New Jersey, May 25th to 28th, and unconfirmed but likely another National will be held in conjunction with the Fox U.S. Open of downhill at Killington, Vermont, September 21st through 24th, if last year's calendar gives us any context.
Yeah, we'll wait and see what happens with the national calendar, but that the dates that we know, and all we can do is speculate based on previous years.
Yep, exactly.
You know what else is newsworthy?
What's that?
We are less than a month away from daylight savings time.
Ooh, that's right. We are. And isn't daylight savings time the weekend of the first downhill Southeast race?
I don't know. Yeah, it just might be. And you know what? We're going to make use of every single waking moment of daylight we have that weekend because racing is back.
So, yes, we will be making the most of all those daylight
and
hours.
That is at the Trials Training Facility?
Yep, the TTC over in Sequatchie, Tennessee, which is outside of Chattanooga. And we'll be there to bring you the race replay series again this season and looking forward to bringing you guys some Hazoot downhill mountain bike action.
Hot dog.
And if you haven't heard, Motion Makers, who was recently acquired by Specialized, they closed down their Cherokee location. And that was connected to the Fire Mountain Outpost right there in town by the Visitor Center. It was a bit of a blow to the cycling community there in Cherokee, but do not fret. The Fire Mountain Outpost will be expanding into that space with their own bike shop. So it's really awesome to hear. Fire Mountain Outpost is brought to us by the crew over at Bryson City Outdoors. So it's rad to see them keeping things going and supporting the Fire Mountain Shredders. And if you recall, we had Jeremy Hyatt on here back at episode 131 to give us kind of the whole rundown of the Cherokee and Fire Mountain scene. So if you haven't listened to that, or if you don't remember it, maybe go get yourself a refresher after this episode.
That's great news for Fire Mountain riders, and I'm thinking they're going to be pretty successful. So I've been deep diving into rehabbing some of the injuries that I've collected over the years and doing some stability exercises to prevent future injuries. Because God knows I'm accident prone and 42 now.
Yeah, like last weekend, didn't you about break your toe when we were riding?
Yeah, I kicked a stump at trail speed, and luckily I only do have,
You're not supposed to kick those.
it had it coming, but I had the worst of it's I've got a black spot on my toenail. It's not as bad as it felt at the time, but because of things like that and just my general luck, first aid's become a focus for me, and it's something that I'm trying to learn everything I can from prevention to trailside triage.
Worth looking into and something that we should be paying attention to.
Do you know how many people go for a ride with their best buds knowing how dumb their friends are?
Yeah.
I mean, I can think of a few people I ride with that I definitely don't want to pop my shoulder back into place or tie my shirt into a splint.
That's something that we all should take into account and something we should maybe like try to figure out and maybe get some professional education on.
Well, luckily, here in Western North Carolina, there's a premier training facility called Landmark Learning that can teach you everything you need to know about outdoor and wilderness first aid. So today, joining me here on the Pisgah podcast, we're going to talk safety. It's not as sexy as new trail building and new equipment and things like that, but it's I don't know a mountain biker that hasn't been injured on the trail or maybe a repetitive use injury. It's part of what we do, and I've had some experiences recently that made me think I really should think a little bit more about what I can do to better prepare myself for these injuries on the trail or for being able to be there for my friends when they get hurt if they're on the trail and I'm on the ride with them. So I've reached out here to Justin Padgett from Landmark Learning. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks. Glad to be here with you.
So why don't you go ahead and give us what your credentials are?
My wife and I, Mari, own Landmark Learning. We started it when we were 25, back in 1996. Our goal was really to create a training center that focused on national standards for people that are in the outdoor recreation industry. At that time, it was pretty unstandardized or non-standardized, and it's kind of evolved into what it is right now. But my background is I'm a paramedic, wilderness EMT. I'm an instructor for NOLS, an instructor trainer for NOLS Wilderness Medicine. I'm also a instructor trainer for the American Canoe Association and on the curriculum committee for the American Canoe Association Swiftwater Rescue Program. In addition to that, I helped create the Wilderness Lifeguard Program and serve on the curriculum committee for the Starfish Aquatics Institute for Wilderness Lifeguard coursework, which is a remote lifeguarding program for folks that have wilderness medicine education and are doing tripping in remote places outside of 911 areas. In addition to that, I spent a lot of my time kayak and mountain biking and raising my kids here in Western North Carolina. I've got teenagers now. We've been here in this area for now, I think 27 years. And I don't know what else to say about that. I think that's probably plenty. Is there anything else you'd like to know?
Yeah, I mean that covers it. That says a lot about it gives you more credibility than anybody else I could think of to talk to about these things. Landmark is where you go to get trained. What kind of classes do you guys offer there?
We focus on a host of wilderness medicine programs, which are NOLS, Wilderness First Responder, Wilderness First Aid. The recertification courses for those courses, wilderness EMT programs, EMT programs, swift water rescue, wilderness lifeguard programs, Leave No Trace Master Educator are the primary programs that we offer. And then in addition to that, we do instructor training that helps instructors to train all of those courses.
Yeah, I guess that's as important as anything is making sure the instructors are trained, right?
Yeah, that's kind of what we hang our hat on. We've always we've always claimed that we're the instructors of instructors, and that's a lot. That's a big claim. I think we've been able to hold on to that over the years, and really fortunate at the people that we've collected that are, you know, aficionados at what they do.
Right on. And so, being that you train the instructors, and for how long you've been doing it, will you say that there's enough adequately trained people out there for to put our minds at ease?
I think it's always evolving, and you know, we've had a really big spike in the recreation economy since COVID. You know, it's like if there's a positive thing to say about COVID, maybe that's it.
I'll agree.
You know, I try to look for things that are positive out there, but the number of persons that are interested in being outdoors and doing organized programming outdoors, and, you know, buying kayaks, buying sups, buying mountain bikes, all these things, you know, for a while there, you couldn't find a mountain bike or a sup or a kayak, you know, and it was just because the industry exploded and, you know, people decided that they wanted to be outdoors. And even though it's 3 years later, it seems that that trend is continuing.
It is.
You know, maybe we can look to the state advocacies, the state advocacy groups from each state that run outdoor programs, like here in North Carolina, to look at their numbers. But I would say that the recreation industry in North Carolina is booming and then some. The biggest challenge right now probably is staffing across the board, from camping to other recreation programs to private entities that do training. That's probably the biggest issue right now.
Yeah, you're so right about that. COVID definitely shook something in a lot of people that recreate outdoors. The amount of, you know, we could talk about how many new bikes got sold during that amount of time, but the thing that I don't think a lot of people account for, the amount of old 10-year-old bikes that were collecting dust in a garage that got dusted off and taken to the bike shop for a tune-up, that happened in that amount of time too. And, you know, that number's not as easy to track as sales of new bikes. And it says a lot more about the volume of people that kind of got back on the horse, so to speak, during the pandemic. Well, obviously the reason why I wanted to talk to you was, you know, about common injuries that we're going to see on the trails. Like I said in the intro, I don't have a friend that I ride bikes with that has not had at least one trip to the ER or significant injury on a trail. And just want to know what your thoughts are on, obviously prevention, but, you know, what are some things that we could do to be better prepared while we are on the trail too?
Well, you know, every time you pack your bag, you know, you make sure your water bladder's full, you make sure your tools are right, you know, you got the right tools for the right bike and like all those kind of things. Well, you got to make sure you have the right tools to fix the human too. So just basic things, you know, basic first aid kit, you know, with items in it that are common. The common injuries are going to be lacerations, you know, any kind of soft tissue injury, you know, briars, impalements, you know, gashes, road rash, you know, all those type of things. Often in the field, you know, when we clean wounds, we just use the water that's available. But when we get home, we need to really, you know, do justice and really clean it out well. You know, I think of all the times when I've stopped bleeding with my t-shirt or even bandaged something with parts of my clothing or somebody else's clothing, and then, you know, later didn't really pay attention to it as well as I needed to, and maybe it got infected. So aftercare is pretty important. You know, most of the time we're going to get soft tissue injuries. That's probably the biggest thing, but some musculoskeletal injuries, when you come off the bike and you land funny, I think of landing with your arm outstretched just to protect your face.
I've been to the ER with a boxer's fracture for that.
Totally. You know, it's like, you think about it, maybe it was more important before you met your partner in life. You know, you were like, when you get ready to land, you see your face going at something and you're like, I don't know,
I'm too pretty
shoulder,
for this
arm, a bike, something into that so that my face doesn't hit it first. And so yeah, that's pretty common. When that happens, maybe you dislocate a shoulder, or you know tweak your wrist or your elbow. Those things are really common. I you know, it seems like a lot of folks that ride their crashes all the way out damage their fingers, you know, either just holding on, you know, relentlessly holding on to the handlebars and the brake system and the, you know, gear levers, and they just crash with that. And so their fingers are injured, you know, that kind of thing. So finger dislocations, shoulder dislocations, sprains to wrists, you know, it seems like, you know, correct me if I'm wrong about this, but it seems like the folks I see out riding are less clipless, more flats.
Yeah. It's caught some traction. Yeah. A lot of people are riding flats nowadays, especially on a bigger travel bike.
I don't
bike.
Know if that helps or not. It seems like for people that ever had trouble, you know, if their clipless were on too tight or there was ice involved or mud or something, and they couldn't get out of their clipless, like that's, you know, that's a calamity of its own, you know?
Yeah.
That causes a problem that just kind of snowballs usually when you can't get off your bike.
That's taking some collarbones out for sure. Especially on well, road riders. I mean, it's a common injury with road riders is you go down so fast that you couldn't put your hand out, and you tend to go straight to the shoulder there. So
yeah, there was no plan. Mm-hmm. There was no plan for it. Well, you know, that does bring me to one thought pattern, and that's about helmet safety. Lots of new research in the world of helmet safety these days, and what's protecting brains the best. Seems like the material that the helmet is made of seems to matter a little bit less, but the ability for the helmet to displace energy is really important. And so you see more helmets that can take a hit, and the energy, maybe there's like plates, the helmet's made out of plates, so that one plate can only carry so much energy and it discharges.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty interesting new technology in helmets. But the other issue has always been suspension, you know, and making sure your head, just kind of like that egg drop test when you were in ninth grade, you know, or eighth grade, that your head is in a suspension system that keeps you from taking a direct hit.
Right.
It is kind of important. And that your helmet's well fitted, you know, that it actually is on your head so that when you hit the ground or you hit a tree or another biker or a rock or whatever it is, you're still wearing your helmet when it's over.
The highest safety rated helmet on the market is not going to do anything for you if it doesn't fit correct.
Yeah, that's right. And then also, you know, I see folks sometimes, you know, in the kayaking world, we have watched this phenomenon where full face helmets came around. And then all of a sudden people that were at these rivers that they didn't really have the experience for, but they had more confidence because they at least had a full face helmet.
Right. Yeah.
It's like, you may keep your teeth, but it still is going to cause you a lot of bodily harm. You know, it's like that's really not the deal. So, you know, I see shoulder pads and, you know, body armor and things like that are very helpful, especially when people are doing big jumps and where there's large consequences, no matter your skill level, you know, there's always that day where you're slightly off. So, you know, those things are really helpful, but you know, what's dangerous sometimes maybe is when those things take the place of experience and create confidence that's basically illegitimate, you know, and it pushes people to do things they wouldn't normally do. I've always thought that about GoPros and some of the video stuff, just pushing people to do things that they might not normally do.
Even Strava, I think, does that.
Yeah.
That makes, well, it gives people a benefit for going faster than they're comfortable going sometimes.
Well, you know, we all love those disc brakes.
Yeah.
There's no upsetness from that. Anybody who's ever had elastomer brakes that went to that, you know, they know that's the, you're going to go faster because, you know, you can stop sooner.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you asked earlier, like, what are these most common things that people get when they're mountain biking? And I would believe it's soft tissue injuries and then musculoskeletal injuries that are pretty minor, basically. Just having things that you can do wound cleaning with. You know, sometimes we get grossly contaminated wounds and we get impalements and things like that, and we need iodine in the mix of the wound cleaning. Most of the time, the wound cleaning is all about irrigation. So having some kind of irrigation syringe and ability to scrub. You know, folks that are going home, like you go out during the day and you get beat up and you go home at night, you know, maybe just you keep like some wound care stuff even in your vehicle so you can really do better of it. You can do a better job before you wrap it up, put your clothes on and head home or head out to dinner or whatever before you go home. And it's like that would mean a lot for bacterial infections and just injury management. In the field, you need things that are going to stop bleeding. You know, it seems rare that somebody needs a tourniquet in the world of mountain biking, but
I keep one with me.
Things that are common are going to be just pressure bandages, some sterile dressings, things like that, that are in some kind of waterproof container. You know, I really like in my mountain bike bag, what I have is I have mostly soft tissue injury stuff and a couple of ACE wraps and like some ibuprofen, things of that nature. Not a lot, maybe a sling, a couple of cravats for a sling and swath. Not much, a little bit of information that I can do some documentation with, maybe like a patient assessment report that I can take vital signs down or do an assessment of somebody, but generally not a whole lot. And then what that goes into is it goes into a waterproof bag that I make airtight and suck all the air out of. And then I just put that inside my bike bag where my water bladder is. And it kind of lives there. I try to make sure that the medication doesn't expire, or if there's iodine or other medications like antibiotic ointment or things like that that are in there, I try to make sure those don't expire over time. Mm-hmm. I keep a little checklist of those things. But other than that, you know, pretty simple, especially for the day tripper, you know, ready to stop bleeding, ready to deal with the musculoskeletal injury. Pretty helpful. I think in general, you'd rather have better materials than your t-shirt.
Yeah. Something to absorb it that's not covered in sweat.
Yeah, and you might want that shirt later instead of cutting it up, you know.
Yeah.
Might be your favorite shirt.
No, I'm glad you brought up the tourniquet thing, because after a friend of mine had an injury where he got where somebody had done trail work, they'd cut branches back and it was really sharp and stabbed him in the shin. Another friend of ours, wife who is or she's a friend of ours too. I don't know why I said it that way, but yeah, Lindsay, shout out. She's a trauma surgeon, an ER trauma surgeon. Uh-huh. She's like, you guys need to carry tourniquets. She's like, you cut the, you know, make it not bleed and don't worry about the rest and let us worry about that when you get to the ER. But, you know, the first thing is you want to make sure that it's not bleeding too bad. And this guy, he wound up having to get some skin grafts and things to repair the injury.
Wow.
So it wasn't nothing.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty serious. I'd say, you know, if you're going to have a tourniquet, maybe the easiest thing to do would be to buy a manufactured tourniquet as opposed to try to improvise one.
Yeah.
You know, you can improvise one in a pinch, but you need the training for that and you need the practice for that. Or it's
you don't want to use a shoelace unless you have to, or, you know.
Yeah, it's not something that you're going to be prepared to do. It seems like a good idea. Like, oh, I'll just use a shoelace. But if you've not planned to do that and practiced to do that, then you're not ready to do that.
Yeah.
You know, so right now the combat application tourniquet, the CAT tourniquet, mm-hmm. is probably the number one tourniquet that's on the market. And I'm not really interested in pushing commercialism of tourniquets, but that's likely what's out there the most and has an application opportunity where a person can just put it on themselves.
Yeah. That's what it's the CAT Generation 7 tourniquet is what I was told to not compromise on. Don't get the knockoff version.
Yeah, isn't that funny? There's that many versions of it.
Yeah, well, that's good. That means, you know, that means the technology and the use cases of it have improved the quality. I feel like I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's evolved. You're right. It's evolved over time. I think it was 2010 when tourniquets came back into the EMT curriculum. So for many, many years, tourniquet was kind of like a bad word. In fact, sometimes we called it the T word, and we would suggest that if you put a tourniquet on someone, you're making a choice of limb over life. And that's not always true. It may be true in some circumstances, but that's not always true, especially when you can get surgical care, like your friend's suggesting.
Yeah.
You know, pretty soon, you know, probably in the next 4 to 6 hours, maybe, or less, seems like we're less concerned about it. You know, tourniquets in the military theater have been used when in doubt, put a tourniquet on. And part of that decision making is about how quickly it can be removed and evaluated by, you know, competent medical professionals. And I think that really exists. You know, think about where in Western North Carolina are you where you're mountain biking, as long as you're mobile, as long as you're still moving, you can get out of wherever you are that day.
Yeah. It might take a few hours, but yeah, I mean, there it's remote, you know. Then that's kind of one of the another one of the reasons why I wanted to speak to you about these things is that, yeah, you know, we know what to do afterwards when we get back to the car, but you know, we got to worry about getting back to the car sometimes. And if you're limping along, it might take a little bit.
Yeah, I would say always having like a little bit of a survival kit. That's been a new emphasis in recent times in the kayaking and canoeing world is encouraging people to not only be ready to do certain rescues and have that equipment, but also have a certain amount of survival equipment in case you end up someplace that you didn't anticipate you would be for longer than you wanted to be there. Mm-hmm. And whatever that means to you. And so those are basic things like, you know, being able to build a shelter. And that could be a personal shelter. For me, it's always meant, you know, at least a couple of large trash bags, you know, something like, you know, construction quality or maybe even like roadside cleanup type of trash bag so that I can create insulation, basically trap radiation, create a shelter or even create a rain jacket out of it. And then always having some version of light, really two versions of light. In the caving world, we go for three versions of light, but you know, in general, in the outdoor recreation world, at least a plan and then a backup. And it's so funny. And I don't know if you remember back when we used to have like halogen lights and stuff, and you'd be like, bring an extra bulb and bring extra batteries and bring an extra headlamp. And now it's like, well, bring your headlamp and another headlamp and you're probably all right. Like the chances of that not working are not really good if the batteries were good to go, you know, at the beginning.
LEDs are awesome.
It's game changer. Yeah. So you know, having light, you know, having some like basic warmth stuff. So like for me, I call it my smock, but I just went mountain biking the other day. And when I come down the mountain, I come through a lot of water. And it was like 28 degrees outside. And as I came through all this water, I put it's like a Sierra Designs pullover. And it lives in my bike bag. Like I never wear it. It's crazy. It's like pink and yellow and turquoise. And like someone gave it to me a long time ago. And I'm like, I know what to do with it. I'm going to put it in my bike bag, you know. And it's like when I go downhill, I put that thing on and it keeps me from getting wet. And so if I can keep from being wet, sometimes I can stay warmer longer, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And so that always lives in there. And then a pair of glove liners and a head beanie. And then in certain circumstances, an extra pair of socks, like cold toes, you know, you should never tolerate cold toes. I think people forget about that during the wintertime, especially mountain biking, like road bikers don't forget about it. Like they have a plan for that, but mountain bikers are just like,
yeah.
I'm going to take my regular mountain bike and stuff. And I'm going to put my toes in a 25 miles an hour and 25 degrees with a 10 mile headwind. And you add all that together and that means cold, frozen toes.
Yeah, it does.
But you know, just having stuff that's going to keep you warm, you know, and you know, telling people where you go, we've gotten so like soloist. And I'm always one about that. I rarely kayak alone, but I mountain bike alone a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, telling somebody where you're going, giving them an expectation of when you're coming back, maybe even bringing your phone with you and turning the location device on so that somebody could find you if you're missing. You know, that seemed to be really important anymore. The road bikers use road ID, but for us in the backcountry, you know, either we have a cell phone with satellite service or we told somebody where we were going.
Yeah. Somebody, people aren't going to come across you. People have to know to go look for you versus on the road, at least somebody might see you in a ditch.
That's right. I mean, and think of the places that we go on a mountain bike. Like part of the reason we do that is because we're traveling distance. Like we would go places, run. You go somewhere running, you're going to run like 4 miles. 6 miles, maybe. You go mountain biking, you're going to double that at the minimum. You know, it's like easy.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not easy, but you're going to, the part of mountain biking is about distance and it's about distance challenges. So when you're by yourself and you do that, it's just really important to let other people know somebody where you're going and when you should come back and where your car should be parked and you know, how to be able to follow up on you to know if you're okay and how to start finding you if you're not coming back.
Yeah, all those are very, very key things to do. I agree with all of those recommendations 100%. Another one that comes to mind, what about things that, you know, aren't necessarily ride related, but wildlife related, like getting swarmed by some yellow jackets and maybe you got bit by a snake. Things that all are very possible in Western North Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, those things are absolutely possible in Western North Carolina. It you know, one of the things that seems to be nice is that most of what we hear in conversation and also see in media is that mountain bikers and bears don't have bad interactions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've always been concerned I'd come around a corner and just like nail a bear, you know, like come around the corner and I'm just like flying. I got everything's lubed up super well. It's making almost no sound. You know, I'm coming through the woods just ripping and I come around the corner
sneak
and
sneak up on mama bear.
The crud out of some bear and just like hit them. You know, it's like run into them. You know, and it's like, well, what are they gonna do? Are they gonna like, is that the end of me at that moment? or are they gonna run away? And it seems like run away seems to have the majority of the incidents that we hear about, you know, and I don't have any data to support that, but it does seem that way.
It's been my experience. I've seen tons of bears in the past 15 years out here, and I've never had any, I wouldn't even say a close encounter, and I've been within 10 feet of many bears.
I think mostly the issue comes to running into dogs has always been kind of the issue, whether it's a dog with somebody in the backcountry that's unleashed or whether it's a dog that maybe is with a pack of other dogs that is part of a hunting group that's lost or cold or hungry or something. Seems like those seem to be more common, or somehow, you know, we've been mountain biking and we stumbled upon some private property and the next thing you know, there's a couple of Rottweilers there that are guarding some, you know, field or something. As far as snakes go, you know, snake management really is about wound care and then monitoring for signs and symptoms that the person has gotten envenomation, you know, things like an increased heart rate, increased respiratory rate, pale or gray skin, free bleeding from the site's kind of a big indicator around here that you've been hit by one of the pit vipers. So like a copperhead or a rattlesnake or a water moccasin, one of those snakes, or what's prevalent around here, probably copperheads have the market.
Yeah,
and the more you bleed from the site, the more it's giving you its venom. That person will start to have signs and symptoms of shock, or the signs and symptoms I discussed a minute ago, just increased heart rate, respiratory rate, gray or pale skin, and then maybe even an altered mental status, heavy sweating. And generally speaking, we wash the site. Splinting the site is important. Folks can learn how to splint and how to do wound care in a wilderness first aid course. So we always recommend, you know, training when folks can do that. And then evacuation to a medical facility. The medical facilities here in Western North Carolina are prepared to evaluate and make decisions around snake bites.
That's good to know.
It's enough of an issue that all of the ERs here are prepared for that. So it really doesn't matter where you are. If you go to an ER, you should get appropriate medical care for venomous snake bites. Let's see. What else did we talk about? We talked about, you said snake bite. What else did you mention?
Bee stings or yellow jackets are pretty prevalent out here.
Seems like the biggest issue of bee stings seems to be more during the summer, like July and August, huh? Like you're cruising down the trail and like you just pound the trail and piss off a ground hornet nest, and then the next thing you know, you run over it, a couple of those bees hit you, and then many more of those bees hit the person behind you. You know,
and
it's like that's kind of how it goes.
They don't give up.
Yeah, it's like snake bite sometimes is the same way. The first person startles, you know, the snake, and then the people behind them get bitten. But with bees, you know, kind of the biggest issue is just what's the person's resilience and history with allergic reactions?
Yeah.
You know, do they have strong allergic reactions? Does their face swell up? You know, do antihistamines like Benadryl do those manage their signs and symptoms, or do they need something more like epinephrine, which is a prescription drug that we use to manage this problem? Anybody who's had an allergic reaction in the past should always carry, you know, medication with them that's going to support this happening in the future, especially if it comes from environmental irritants, you know, like bees or something of that nature. So they're just prepared to deal with it. You know, in remote cases, without medication, you may not survive, to be honest, in those circumstances. You know, there are some things in medicine that, like, you can prevent or you can make better, you can have simple treatments for. And then there are other medical problems that require specific medication. And without those specific medications, you don't have a treatment for the problem. And that's the truth with severe allergic reactions that may come from either fire ants or from the order of Hymenoptera, which is actually bees, hornets, wasps, and I mentioned, you know, fire ants.
Yeah, that's scary. I can break an arm. I'm not scared about that. But if I get stung by hornets, I pitch a temper tantrum like a toddler that got their lollipop taken away. And I'm not even allergic. I just hate it. So that covers those things. Let's think about one of the concepts that I've been playing with in my head here is, you know, you've got your group of people you go ride with, whether it be your buddy, your partner, you got a group of four or five people. You always, you know, you got your friends that want to send the jumps and set Strava records. But the concept that I'm playing with here is having the one person on the ride that's your dedicated triage, your person that's going to keep it together and not send those jumps and is just going to be along for the ride. And that's the person that's going to keep the first aid kit, so to speak, and just, you know, be the responsible person. You know, it's kind of like your DD for a night out, but instead it's just the person that you can rely on when you go for a ride. That way you can take comfort in knowing somebody's going to be there and maybe even have better luck at sending those jumps and setting your Strava records or whatever you're out there doing.
I think that's hilarious that you say that. And it seems to make a lot of sense, especially when you correlate it with a designated driver, that you just have somebody in the group has that mindset. You know, in the river industry, that person is always the sweeper. Mm-hmm. That's what we call them. And they, you know, whether it's a raft or a kayak, you know, that person usually has a good knowledge of the space that we're in, but also is the person who's watching the other people, maybe, you know, especially the folks that are newer at what they're doing, and they're bringing up the rear. So they're like the cleanup if something goes wrong on the river. But I see the same issue in a cave. I see the same issue, you know, on the trail, whether you're hiking or high-speed hiking, as I call it, when we're mountain biking.
Yeah. If you have a person that's designated, obviously think that, you know, that person should be trained, not just having the equipment, but training. So what does a class for that person look like if they were to come to Landmark and get trained?
Well, you know, what we really recommend is that folks take an entry-level course in wilderness medicine. The access is pretty easy. It's 2 days, 16 hours, wilderness first aid. It covers the basic things that statistically happen in backcountry settings, including wounds, infection management, heat and cold illness, fracture management, things of that nature. And, you know, we frame the whole course with the concept of patient assessment. So how do you evaluate another human, my friend, even somebody I don't know, how do I evaluate another human and know if that human is okay? Is that human doing well? Do they have life threats? Do they have lesser problems? And then what's the best way to remove this person from the backcountry? You know, should they go to the hospital, number one? And then if they do need to go, what's the best way to go? Like, should we carry them? Should we assist them? Should we go get outside help to come in? All those decision-making pieces are discovered inside of a wilderness first aid course, which is what we recommend as a kind of an entry-level piece. You know, most of the guides and folks that are managing trips and the ones that are teaching climbing and teaching biking throughout our industry are largely wilderness first responders. And those folks, you know, have a 9-day program, but WFA is a completely appropriate for husband and wife, you know, any spouses that like to hang out together and ride or go in the woods, you know, folks, the son, daughter, you know, father, mother, all that kind of stuff. Everybody in the family should go and do some of this stuff. Not to mention just people that hang out and go big. You know,
yeah.
You know, the folks that hang out and go big should definitely do it. It's funny that at times, you know, with as many years as I've been teaching wilderness medicine, I'll have students come to class, and for several years, you know, they're in tabloids, whether they're a kayaker or a mountain biker or a windsurfer or whatever, whoever it is, mountaineer. And they come to these classes and they're like, they've already hit stardom. They're already really good at what they do. And they've defied death like a million times. And then they come to these classes and they're like, oh, you know, they have no idea, you know, like, oh, that's what's going on. That's what can happen. Oh, that's what happened to that guy. And they kind of have like a little dose of reality, you know, to mix in with their, you know, heroism, you know, all the crazy things they've been doing. So that's always kind of fun.
Yeah. Your luck will get you so far.
Yeah, we can always be a little bit better educated, and you know, you don't need to be paranoid. Like, you can't run around being paranoid that something's going to happen, but you prepare for things that might happen that are reasonable. And then you are confident in your decision making. And that means a lot, especially when you have to make decisions about things you don't commonly make decisions about. And that's wilderness medicine. You know, most of us are just going to go mountain biking and we just hit the woods with our friends. And we might have a kind of a folly or two, but really not too much. And we end the day kind of as usual. And then other times you might go mountain biking and, you know, you're caring for somebody else that you don't even know, that doesn't know what they're doing, doesn't know where they are. And you're the person that can care for them. So being prepared to do that seems important as maybe even just a support for our industry. You know, it's like mountain bikers support mountain bikers and recreationalists support recreationalists, hikers help hikers, kayakers help kayakers. That's just, you know, how it goes when you see people in the field that need help, whether it's heat illness or equipment malfunction or whatever it is.
You just said something about somebody not knowing where they're at. So that triggers a thought. What about concussions? What do you know, that is, we talked about helmet safety earlier, but that's the outcome. If it doesn't work, you know, I've seen it. I've seen people get knocked out.
You know, that's pretty real, especially with as many dedicated jumps that we have in our, you know, out there right now. I go to these trails and I'm like, okay, you can ride this trail, but you know, at this one point in the trail, there's a dedicated gap.
Well, it doesn't take the gap. It could just be a branch sticking out the wrong way and pulls your wheel out from underneath you. I've seen probably the gnarliest concussions I've seen have come from just something you didn't even see it. You didn't know it was there. And
you didn't know it was coming.
Yeah.
You know, the biggest thing to think about is that when somebody has a loss of responsiveness, so they're unable to tell you their name, where they are, what time of day it is, and kind of the general vibe of what's going on, like what's happening right now. When they can't tell you those four things, and that person often has some level of injury to their brain. It's a traumatic brain injury as soon as the person has an altered mental status. So those persons, even if they recover fully, should always be seen by an emergency room. You know, we're all stubborn. You know, I was much more stubborn in my 20s than I am now. But I can tell you a lot of times when I take really big whacks doing all kinds of stuff, and I wasn't about to go to the ER, but I can tell you now that it's a good idea.
Yeah.
You never know what the outcome will be. Maybe it's not a problem. Maybe it is. And it's worth checking out, because any altered mental status, as soon as the person is confused of events, they're not sure what happened, they're not sure who they are, they don't respond well when you talk to them, any of that stuff happening directly following a blow to the head, whether they're wearing a helmet or not, whether they have injury to the outside of their head or not, it really doesn't matter. It appears that they have suffered what we say in the layperson world as a concussion, but in science would be a TBI, a traumatic brain injury.
Yeah, I've seen some of those, and you know, we we can visibly see what happens when you dislocate a shoulder, or you know, you have any of your normal breaks and sprains, but you don't see that brain injury, and sometimes you don't see it for weeks or months after you even get it, and that's terrifying.
Yeah, the head injury piece is a big deal. Sometimes really small head injuries create long-term problems. They don't create an acute, like a, all of a sudden, big-time problem, like the person's unresponsive and not breathing well right now. Like, it didn't go that far. But it's enough that it's caused enough neural damage that over time it causes all kinds of things, from headaches to sensitivities to light to confusion to not sleeping well to, you know, all kinds of things. So it's just worth being checked out if you ever have an altered mental status when you hit your head while you're biking.
Yeah, for sure. That one I'm definitely going to be more vocal about moving forward now that I have that in the front of my thought.
I think about Muhammad Ali a lot, you know. It's like, yeah, how many licks did that guy take before somebody told him taking licks is not okay?
Really? I mean, 100%. Yeah. And at that time, you know, the science, you know, for a TBI is not what we have now.
That's
especially
right.
When we have things like CTE, which we have seen professional BMX riders. Unfortunately, you can't diagnose that one until post-mortem, but, you know, it's a very real possibility.
We're learning more about traumatic brain injuries, largely through sports medicine.
Yeah.
I always thought military medicine would take the cake on that, but because just money, you know, it's like science follows money or money follows science. I'm not sure which way it goes, but you got to have both of them together. And sports medicine really is the one that has the information on that. It'd be helpful to take a look at the back to play criteria that's used often in either soccer or football or contact sports in general, which is about helping people that have had a traumatic brain injury rest and not have any cognitive involvement for 24 hours or more until their signs and symptoms resolve. They should not be engaged in any kind of big way. That means like cell phones, maybe even music, yeah, TV, like any of those kind of things, because your brain has to repair and rest, complete rest is the number one way that it does that. And your neurons rebuild. You know, humans are pretty amazing. You can't grow a tail back, but man, you can regrow neurons. That seems pretty important.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, it's wild because, you know, we tear pull ligaments and ligaments don't regrow, but your brain can.
Yeah.
So
your brain, your lungs, a lot of your cells in your body can regrow after you've damaged them.
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
Well, let me ask you, what have I not asked that would be obvious to you?
You know, the biggest thing I just really suggest to folks is, you know, think about what happens on your trips. You know, like what has happened in the past? You know, what injuries do you get? And then build a first aid kit that supports that.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Good, you know? So good to think about.
Whatever that is, you know. Everybody's first aid kit doesn't need to look like everybody else's. And, you know, it's nice to buy like a commercial kit. Going to a store and buying like a commercial kit is kind of nice because it comes in a bag that has compartments and things like that. But what will happen over time is that first aid kit will morph into something that's more usable because you'll use up items that are in it and you'll replace them with the things that you really prefer. And that's really kind of the way to get going with a first aid kit. I can tell you, I got a lot of first aid kits that are just in small dry bags or Ziploc baggies inside of small dry bags. I got a lot of that, yeah. But you know, having that available, having maybe a bigger first aid kit in your car.
That's my method. Yeah, I've got a pretty significant like military style IFAC kit that I keep in the car. I even have skin staples in it. I mean, it's got a lot of cool stuff that I hope I never have to use. But yeah, I've got basically it's a little dry bag. It's like a cell phone underwater dry bag that I have my trailside stuff in.
That's great. Yeah, just blood stoppers, wound care, blister management. Probably some iodine for when something gets really infected, you know, just grossly contaminated, get like a bunch of grunge and a stick inside of you. Probably going to need some iodine for that.
Yeah. And then you're thinking about who you're riding with too. You know, for example, I'm not going to name names, but you're like, oh hell, I'm riding with so-and-so this weekend. I remember what happened three rides ago. So.
No, that's exactly right. You know, one thing we hadn't talked about this whole time is, you know, just medications that people take, you know, just knowing people's medical histories that you hang out with. You know, it's a crazy thing, but as we get older, our friends have medical histories. Like when we were 20, nobody really had a medical history that we knew about.
Right.
And then at 40 and 50, like you got high blood pressure and a heart murmur and, you know, you have a seizure disorder and you have, sometimes you have this abdominal cramping thing that happens and, you know, and just making sure that, you know, whoever you're riding with has some idea about that stuff. So it's not a surprise if you have a problem. It's not a weakness. It's a, I don't know, for me, it's camaraderie. It's, you know, like the Musketeers, you know, we're all in this together. Mm-hmm. And the more I'm available to help you, the better. I've got really close friends that I kayak with that have asthma issues. And at the put in, we'll be about to launch and I'll look over at them and I'll say, hey, got your inhaler with you? How about a backup inhaler? And they're like, oh yeah, I'll be right back.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like things like that, just some camaraderie around it. You know, it's not a problem. I want you to be well while we're on out in the field.
And you'll never know how many times you doing that has actually saved, maybe not necessarily their life, but their experience that day, or, you know, your experience that day just by doing that.
Yeah, make it more comfortable. You know, and it's like, you don't think you're going to have an asthma attack today, or you don't think you're going to have trouble with your blood sugar today, or, you know, whatever. You don't think you're going to have trouble with that trick knee that you normally have, but bring that brace anyways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and because I know about it, I can be supportive to you about it. It's not a clutch at all. We just want to go have fun and we want to come back unscathed.
And if it were completely safe, I don't think we'd be as interested in it. So we got to account
That's
for that
right.
too, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we'll take some minimal beat downs.
Yeah.
You know, nothing that's going to take us out of the game next time.
That's right. Well, I really appreciate you talking with me about all this stuff. But before you go, I'm going to ask you, what is the gnarliest wilderness backcountry injury that you have personally seen and treated?
Man, I hate to sound so anticlimactic about this, but I don't think I have an answer for you. I think of times when just, you know, being surprised about things is probably the biggest problem. I don't like being surprised. You know, when you're surprised, you don't respond as well. But I don't think I have a very specific issue that I can think of. Probably shoulder dislocations are a major problem.
Yeah.
For mobility, and you're done riding a mountain bike when you get a shoulder dislocation, even if it's reduced.
Yeah.
And I can think of times where shoulder dislocations are really common. I remember we were training one year in 1990 for the Carolina Fat Fever Mountain Bike Festival over at Camp Carolina. And we did this one downhill there and a member of our group dislocated his shoulder. And we created a sling for him with a tube. And then the camp wasn't open yet. So this is like April. And the Fat Fever Festival was maybe like in May or something. I'm not sure. Or maybe later April, but there was nobody there. So we had to go from there all the way to the hospital in Transylvania County.
Wow.
Walking this person and assisting them on their mountain bike with their shoulder dislocation. That does come to mind when I think about mountain biking.
Yeah, I'll say
yeah,
that.
Just,
I've been dealing with, you know, a shoulder injury for a while now from a dislocation. So
yeah, now what I do is I have more slow-mo wrecks.
Yeah.
You know, I see something about to happen. I slow down, grab a tree, let go of the mountain bike.
Yeah.
I'm like back here on this tree like a sloth and the mountain bike keeps going.
Uh-huh.
But I saw what was about to happen and I just left.
Yeah. Understand that. Well, I guess tell everybody where they can find you on social media and about Landmark's maybe schedule or whatever however you want to lay that out for the listeners.
You know, our website is pretty easy to find, landmarklearning.org. The calendar page is there. We service about 3,000 students a year here in the southeastern United States. Likely about a third or so of those students actually come to our campus in Cullowhee. And then outside of that, students are in programs throughout the Southeast at colleges and universities and parks and recreation programs, camps, some private guiding services. But you can find our calendar at landmarklearning.org, and we'd love to have folks in class that are interested in looking out for their fellow riders and folks they recreate with, their family members. I think the future is us being in the woods together, and you know, taking care of ourselves, taking care of each other helps us to do that more.
For sure. Well, I'm going to look at that schedule. I'm going to try to get scheduled up sometime here in the springtime, because I feel a sense of urgency about it now.
Well, man, I really enjoyed talking to you. Thanks, Drew.
So, Drew, the first thing I kind of think of after listening to all of this is that as a bike rider, I think so much about the things that I need to bring on a bike ride, but mostly they're all bike focused, right? I've got my tube, I've got a bacon strip for a plug, I've got a spare chain link, a zip tie, like all this stuff to work on my bike, but nothing to work on a human. My bike can't get me out of the woods if I can't make my bike get me out of the woods.
It's true. And with our nice high tech, you know, super light clothing and shoes that have straps and boas rather than laces, we don't really have a ton of things we can improvise these things with in an emergency. So knowing the right tool for the job and having it available or at least back at your vehicle so that if you have to limp back, you can get there, or even just people knowing where you're at when you're riding is super important just in case something bad were to happen.
Yeah, man, there's so much stuff. I mean, it's almost like this is kind of a wake-up call to me and hopefully to a lot of listeners. You know, it's easy to pack along a couple of first aid things. It doesn't take much. I mean, like a decent first aid kit is, like you guys said, like smaller than a tube. And you can find somewhere to put that on your bike or in your bag.
For sure. And I don't mean to be a Debbie Downer or a buzzkill with any of this. If anything, it kind of lightens your conscience and lightens your trailside manner when you realize that maybe you do have what it takes to take care of some of these emergencies that happen and can enable you to actually let loose and have a little bit more fun. And let's definitely take into account the designated first aid person on each ride. Not all of you have to be sending it. Just nominate one and take
that's
turns.
That's such a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that idea a lot. It definitely rings true because sometimes you need to be the responsible party when you got a bunch of dudes just hucking it to flat and stuff.
And honestly, some of my friends that are the huck it to flat types, I don't want them putting a bandage on me.
Hopefully we can get everyone at least somewhat educated and knowledgeable on what it takes, what needs to be done, and kind of what you need to be familiar with so that when someone is in one of those scenarios, someone in the group has the knowledge and experience to apply what they've learned.
Right on. Well, with that down, let's talk about the weather.
Yeah, the weather. Wow. Like we talked about at the top of the show, full spring. I don't know, man. It just keeps looking like springtime temps. You know, we had that threat of winter weather this past weekend, but the next 10 days, all of the highs are at least the mid-50s. We've got some rain looking like it's going to come in Thursday night into Friday morning. The weekend looks amazing. Highs in the mid-50s up to 60. Monday, high 66. But then next week, looks like we got some rain coming in and actually looks even warmer. So, yeah, if you've got a weekend open to come ride bikes, you should do it.
You know, next week when it starts raining and getting cold, we get to go someplace nice and warm and dry.
Yes, we will be somewhere nice and warm and dry. Well, guys, that is a wrap on this week's episode. And as always, you can find us on social media. Just search Pisgah Podcast. And we've got our web store going. We've got shirts, water bottles, koozies. You can check all that stuff out at pisgahpodcast.bigcartel.com.
And if you've ever had a trailside close call, but you had the know-how to save the day, then click subscribe. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Old episodes are being uploaded. Buy some Pisgah Podcast merchandise to support the show.
Hey Drew, when's the last time you've checked your chain wear?
I don't even know if I know how to the right way, to be honest with you, Mangler.
I just thought that the other day when I saw my chain checking tool, and I was like, I should probably check my chain, but I still haven't checked it yet.
I've got one of those tools. I'm not going to lie. I ain't rightly sure I know what it's telling me when I put it on the chain.
Well, I think it's like if it shakes too much, you need a new chain.
Yeah. I'm pretty good about replacing them periodically anyhow, so I think I'm